Let me just very briefly say something about the community solidarity point, since that's one that was not present in anything that I that you read. So I defined community or solidarity as the principle that people ought to cooperate with each other not simply because what they personally get out of it, but also out of a real commitment to the well-being of others. That's what it means to be in community with others or in solidarity with others. Community refers to the mundane forms of cooperation of everyday life, and solidarity to the forms of cooperation that occur in collective action. But it's, you know, it doesn't really matter. The principle is the same. It's just the context is different. You should cooperate with other people not just out of self-interest, what's good for you, but also out of a concern for the well-being of others. The impact of capitalism on community is pretty complex because I think there's really two different sorts of processes in play. On the one hand, and this is the sort of obvious, more straightforward point, competition and individualism, which are really organic parts of capitalism. They're not just accidental add-ons, a kind of competitive individualism as a way of being in the world. These are organic parts of capitalist market relations, and they undermine solidarity and community. Jerry Cohen, who you'll be reading a lot of in the, towards the end of the semester, he had a very nice formulation of this by saying that capitalism organizes interactions on the basis of greed and fear as the two central motivations for action. Greed to make profits and fear of losing out in competition. So other people are sources of danger or opportunity, but not solidarity. This competitive spirit pits people against each other. It pits people against each other in labor markets. It pits cities, states, and countries against each other in their efforts to attract investment. And that is anti-communitarian. It is against the principle of helping, of cooperating with others for purposes of helping them. But on the other hand, and this is why it's a complicated process, capitalism also erodes all sorts of exclusionary solidarities based on things like race, ethnicity, gender, religion. Capitalism is a corrosive force in the world with respect to certain kinds of exclusionary practices. Both Marx and Weber, both of them, emphasize this, that capitalism destroys status hierarchies. It has at least a tendency to. So one way of thinking about the connection of these processes in capitalism and how it relates to the general problem of solidarity and community is to say that capitalism opens up the possibility of more universalistic solidarities by destroying these traditional forms of exclusion. It opens up that possibility, but it blocks the realization of more universal principles of community and solidarity. It opens up the possibility, but blocks the realization of that possibility. It blocks the realization of the potential for community by fostering competitive individualism, while at the same time breaking down the traditional barriers to more universalistic community by eroding status hierarchies. And that's a kind of general feature of the critique of capitalism, is that it advances and creates potentials but is unable to realize them. That's true with respect to productivity and prosperity. Capitalism creates the potential for universal conditions for human flourishing because of the huge increase of productivity that's generated by its forces of production. It creates that potential but blocks the realization of the potential. So that's, I think, one way of thinking about the general indictment that comes with this critical. Creates the possibility for a broader and deeper democracy, but blocks its realization. All right, enough of my talking. We now have less than usual, but 25 minutes for discussion. And the floor is open to whoever wants to raise an issue. Yeah, Joe.
I guess I have 2 points, but I'll stick to one so that other people have the opportunity to ask their questions. But, one thing I kind of wanted to push back on is the idea that domestic production is like non-capitalist. at least in my view, while like strictly speaking, it's not like something that you do in like a workplace and there aren't like owners and managers and things like that. I sort of see domestic production as taking a very specific form under capitalism, where like Engels, you know, in like the origins of the family, private property in the state, talks a lot about like social reproduction and social reproduction theory as kind of specifically kind of pointing out the way in which domestic production is run within like a capitalist system. I think that like in that way, while it's not like necessarily like capitalist strictly, it's sort of like capitalist with a lowercase c because of the way in which it is kind of reinforced by the specific economic system in which we live.
So this is a really interesting point, and it's something which we will, and this is a theme that we're going to encounter in a whole variety of ways. And it has to do with the following contrast. It's a contrast between saying something that is non-capitalist in its internal structure is functionally compatible with capitalism, functionally compatible. That's one version. Another version is, it's non-capitalist in its form, but it's really capitalist in its essence, because it's not just functionally compatible with capitalism, it is functional for capitalism. That is, it is the way it is because of the functions it serves for capitalism. Now that stronger version, which is what in social theory is called functionalism, is a version of Marxism. There is a form of Marxism which is a functionalist Marxism, which says that capitalism is not just an organizing principle that dominates the economy. Capitalism is a functional totality which subordinates everything to its needs and transforms everything into a functional component of an organic system, a totality. That's a very strong theoretical argument. And it has a certain, it has a certain attraction. It's part of, in the classical theory, that was part of what was called the base and superstructure model of capitalism, where everything that wasn't capitalist was itself functional for capitalism. It's a totalizing theory. It also is the kind of theoretical perspective which makes transformation even tougher than it is in other theoretical positions, because everything has to change, because every piece of the system all fits together like a machine. And so you can't, there's no point of entry for subversion, for transformation of parts, because the parts all fit together in this organic whole. Now, I don't want to dismiss that idea. I think it's way too smooth and functional. I think there are many more contradictory aspects in the social systems in which we live. And that domestic production is a contradictory aspect. It was a constraint on accumulation. It's why it was a constraint on the growth of fast food. Right? Capitalism is much better off when people vacate the home and they do as little as possible of domestic production. They produce as few use values for their own consumption as possible, and they buy everything in the market. Now, it can't both be the case that it's optimal for capitalism to have a massive fast food sector, and it's optimal for capitalism to have domestic production that produces food without labor, labor relations, as use values within a domestic economy based on reciprocity. It can't be true that both are optimal. I think it's the case that the domestic production is suboptimal but compatible. That is, you can have a capitalist economy with a big chunk of human labor being outside of the capitalist economy. It's compatible with it. But it's even better for capitalism to get rid of it and absorb everything into the market. It's a barrier to commodification that people buy the raw materials themselves in the market rather than they buy the manufactured goods in the market. So in the 1950s, when I was growing up, TV dinners were introduced. So the earliest form of fast food was the frozen dinner that you then put in the oven. There weren't microwaves back then. And they were called TV dinners because people ate them while they watched television. They still exist in that form, you know, little trays with the little, but I don't think I don't think they're as big a deal now as they were back 50 years ago. But that was an incursion into a non-capitalist sector, and that was a good thing from the point of view of capital accumulation. So I think that's, and when you think about the texture of the relations in a family, they don't have the character of capitalist relations. They just don't. I mean, people care about each other. They cry when other people are suffering. They go out of their way to do nice things for each other, to produce things that people like. You know, they're concerned about meeting the needs of each other, to each according to need, from each according to ability. Patriarchy, but not capitalism, interferes with that relationship, in my judgment. It's more the patriarchal and gender inequalities that are the source of disruption of the reciprocities of a more egalitarian. In any rate, that's how I would, that would be my counter argument to that. Yeah, to him.
I was actually going to ask about what you just said. Okay. About, do you think that the patriarchy and capitalism are completely separate? I mean, it sounds like capitalism is best served if women are in the labor market, then sexism doesn't really work to capitalism's advantage. So do you think the patriarchy and capitalism are completely separate, or do you think that there are, are they interconnected? How does that work?
Right, so again, it's really, and we'll be really working hard on these ideas. Expressions like really separate and interconnected. I do think they're interconnected. Everything's interconnected. Everything affects each other. Our domestic production, just going back to the previous point, is affected by capitalism because we buy a lot of the technologies we use in the means of, as means of production in the home from a capitalist market. So you buy your microwave, you buy your food inputs generated by the capitalist market, but you use them in non-capitalist ways in the household. So patriarchy is certainly affected by capitalism. The question is whether it's merely a functional component of capitalism or an autonomous source of oppression and inequality, which can be in tension with the demands of capitalism. If we want to ask the question, why is it that in the last 40 or 50 years we've had this extraordinary challenge to traditional forms of male domination? You know, really of an unprecedented character. We're not done by any means. I'm not giving this kind of glib, Pollyannish view, oh, isn't this great, gender is this, of course not. You know, we're still in a world with severe forms of, some places more intense than other, of gender inequality and gender domination, gender oppression. But the transformations in some places in the world, Europe, the United States, a few other places, are really astounding in the last 50 years. Now, if you want to ask, why did it happen now and not 100 years ago? 200 years ago. Why now? What's changed? I think the changes of capitalism have a lot to do with why patriarchy is in such a mess, so defensive. What's basically happened is that the interests of capitalism in a broad labor force and a broad capitalist penetration of the market, so the commodification of everything, those interests were obstructed by strong forms of male domination. And that made it possible for women then to struggle for the transformation. So the changes in the interests of capital wasn't sufficient to destroy, to challenge patriarchy. But it meant that the resistance of men to the challenge declined tremendously. And particularly the resistance fueled by powerful men, men who had resources and could make decisions. And that's what made the system vulnerable to challenge. It still took the struggles of the women's movement and struggles over legislation. I mean, there's all sorts of other things that had to happen before things really took off the way they did. But the space was opened up because of a change in the connection between capitalism and its labor needs and its market needs. At least that's how I would pose it. Yeah, another two-hander.
Well, doesn't capitalism benefit from sexism and from racism and from, because if you have those kind of attitudes in your society, you would have to pay them less as a capitalist.
Right. So I think the way to think of it is that it's contradictory. Capitalism both benefits from and is harmed by. Both are true. In some ways, it benefits from sexism. In other ways, It doesn't. In some ways it benefits from racism, in other ways it doesn't. I think racism and sexism function very differently. They're not, you know, the kind of list approach to oppressions where because they're all forms of oppression, then they all have to work the same way. It's just wrong. They work very differently, racism and sexism. It is important for capitalists to find ways to justify various kinds of intensified exploitation and oppression. You need justificatory rationalizations and ideologies. And racism is one of the ones that's used. And we'll be discussing this question of the functionality of racism for capitalism when we get to that part of the class. On sexism, it just isn't so obvious to me how that it's all that important to the viability of capitalism that women are paid less. It's good. Capitalists prefer to pay anybody less. But, you know, currently women are paid about 75 cents on average, and if you look at the, if you control for the technological context so that they're actually in the same context of productivity, the pay differentials are pretty small then once you control for that sort of thing. Most of the pay differentials come from sex segregation of jobs. Women are doing different sorts of things and those different sorts of things are paid less. More than women and men are paid. There's differentials, but they're not big enough to say capitalism needs this in order to accumulate capital. Given that there are expectations that women will be paid less, of course capitalists are going to take advantage of that expectation. No capitalists will voluntarily pay more than they have to. But that isn't the same thing. It's not the same thing to say capitalism take advantage of sexism to pay workers differently. That's different from saying capitalism needs sexism in order to sustain its rate of profit. Those are different points. Yeah?
It's with the dynamism of capitalism, it seems that the traditional competition is given way more credit than it deserves. It seems that, especially if you think about the space race technology in that era, public goods supplied a lot more dynamism than capitalist competition, it seems to me like, because it was American, everybody
right,
paid for
right,
it.
Right.
I mean, it was competition in regard to competing with Russia, but it wasn't really true capitalist competition that was creating that innovation. It was public goods, education, and systems.
Right. So I agree completely that many of the technological breakthroughs that have occurred in the latter half of the 20th century were fueled by public research monies and public projects of various sorts. That's certainly true. And there's all sorts of infrastructure issues as well, that the building of big infrastructures which facilitates capital accumulation is not itself done by capitalists. It's done by states producing public goods, education being a critical example. Nevertheless, it is also the case that the application of these technologies to the purpose of the economy, that is to the production of goods and services, the application and further development, that's largely come through private competitive initiative. There are exceptions. In the 19th century, it was more true. You know, in the 19th century, state procurement and state projects, except in very narrow areas like arms. It is not the case that the steam engine and the railroad were primarily generated by state initiatives. They were generated by private initiatives and private competition. But it's still really true if you look at the automotive industry and the telecommunications industry, the vast array of consumer electronics and the improvements in the production process, the robotics, isthmus engineering, and so on. This is coming largely from the adaptation and further innovation from some key things that may be produced outside of the capitalist economy. But nevertheless, I think the dynamics, and it does then create a dynamics in capitalism.
The only reason I state it is because I think that knowledge is would be, you know, beneficial in transformation, and people are more critical of where the dynamism comes from, they'd be, I mean, they wouldn't be so afraid to adapt to capitalism.
Right. Yeah, there's a common mistake, which is that because, in fact, it is true that capitalism is dynamic, that is true. It's not a static system. It's a system that's constantly developing the force of production. There's the assumption that alternatives would necessarily be non-dynamic, and that's false. There's every reason to believe at this point in history that you could have probably a faster rate of technological change if there were no patents and no intellectual property. If it was simply abolished, we had a new rule that said anybody could copy anything and use any knowledge for any purpose they want without paying anybody anything. No property rights in knowledge, period. That would probably increase the rate of innovation, not reduce it. So the idea that private property rights in innovation are a necessary condition for technical improvement is just not true. It's a necessary condition for people to make the maximum profits out of their own innovations. That's true. But that's a separate, it's extremely unlikely that the rate of innovation would decline in the absence of patents.
Is this whole concept fall under the capitalism violates liberal egalitarian principles of social justice? All public goods falls under that category? For the most part?
No, the liberal egalitarian principle of social justice is equal opportunity. You know, it's equal opportunity, and that it's unjust for you to impose costs on others. So it's a different issue. The liberal egalitarian view is, what does it mean to have a just society? It means that I cannot impose costs on you without your permission. So pollution is a violation of liberal egalitarian principles, because pollution means, for my advantage, I'm imposing a cost on you. And equal opportunity is the central liberal view of what a just society is. All people should have equal opportunity. And capitalism violates both of those principles. Other questions? Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about this in our study group a little bit this morning, but I was wondering, in your section where you talk about, it's the social justice section, you are talking about brute luck and option luck, and how brute luck in an egalitarian society needs to be accounted for and offset. I just don't know what that would look like.
So option luck, the expression option luck versus brute luck.
Yeah.
Option luck means a gamble that you consciously make. So the simplest example is if you have a lottery, and you buy a ticket and you don't win, you don't deserve compensation. You knowingly went in, as long as you weren't deceived. So it's the odds are posted. You're not deceived. If you enter a poker game and you lose. And that's just the way it is. That's called option luck. Brute luck is you're walking down the street with a friend and you get a lightning hits a tree, a limb falls on you, and you're crippled, and your friend is not. It's just a random thing that happened. So the liberal egalitarian view is that people should be fully compensated for bad luck for which they hold no responsibility. And the full compensation means different things. You know, it's hard to know exactly what it would amount to, but it would mean you would do the best you can to make the person whole, even if it means they absorb a huge amount of resources. So it's fine to impose costs on everybody to have curb cuts and to have wheelchair access to all buildings. That's a rule that raises the costs to everybody. It's more expensive to have public buildings which are fully accessible to a wheelchair handicapped person. But a liberal egalitarian would say that's too bad. That's a necessary cost that everybody has to pay in order to create the conditions for the bad brute luck to be neutralized, to be fully compensated. Does that clarify?
Yeah. I think that I was just wondering exactly how you would, because it makes it sound like you can kind of quantify it and come up with So like, I guess the example helps.
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is you do what you have to do to make the person have access to the means to live a flourishing life. Now, there is a problem that this raises, and the philosophical discussions get really thorny. There's what's called the bottomless pit problem. You know, so some people are disabled to such an extent that it would take the entire resources of the society to bring them up just a bit. Right? Well, how much of the well-being of everybody who's able-bodied are you prepared to sacrifice to improve a little bit the condition of life of somebody who is, through no fault of their own, disabled? And that's referred to as the bottomless pit problem. And these are hard philosophical issues. They involve lots of different dimensions. We're so far away from that being a constraint on our ability to provide people access to the material conditions to live flourishing lives, you know, that it's not a problem. That's not an issue that I think has deep implications for how we actually do things. Yeah. Well, I think you haven't.
So I wanted to go back to something we were talking about yesterday about the contrasters. Mm-hmm. So it seems like the assumption or the starting point for all the arguments that we've been discussing is that understanding the economic structure is kind of the most important or the most powerful way of explaining reality and thinking about possible changes. So I'm wondering if there's two things, like whether there's maybe a danger in, you know, having that assumption, maybe it excludes other things, or is there like really a hierarchy of like that is actually the most important thing that we should be focusing on? And then a side question to that, in the Marxist tradition, is it that capitalism is best explained by prioritizing like economic explanations? Or that is it a proposal that like all societies and like human history can be explained, especially on economic terms?
Okay. So that specific, the side question,
yeah,
is what we'll be talking about in particular in the very last module of the course, the theory of history. That is, how general can we make these arguments? The Marxian term for the most general attempt is called historical materialism. On the first issue, I don't think it's possible to say, independent of what it is you're trying to explain, that the economic is the most important, or that anything is more important than anything else, in a completely decontextualized, abstract way. Right? So, for some problems, understanding economic exploitation and the mechanisms which keep it in place and that obstruct its transformation, for some problems, that's the crucial thing. It's central. For other things, it's part of a context, but isn't the most important thing to focus on. So I think the question of explanatory importance always has to be specified with respect to a problem that you're trying to explain. When you think about other domains besides society, this is obvious. So in medicine, somebody who would say genetics is always the most important explanation of diseases, you'd say, what? I mean, you know, it's not always the most important. Sometimes it is. It may be that genetics are implicated in every disease because how vulnerable you will be to a given virus may depend upon your immune system, which may depend upon your underlying genetics, which determine whether you have the kind of immune system that fights viruses effectively or ineffectively. So it may be that genetics are a relevant explanatory process in every disease, but only in some diseases would we say, yes, the central explanation for why you are sick and somebody else is not is because of your bad luck with your genes. Okay? Now, that's the way I think we should think about class analysis in general and the economic more explanations that are characteristic of Marxism. For some problems, they are central. And the problems for which they are central turn out to be pretty important problems for human beings. You know, They have a lot to do with what are the obstacles to human flourishing and what has to be transformed in order to change those obstacles. So the economic structures, I think, play a very important role in that kind of problem. But even for that kind of problem, there are aspects of oppression and marginalization and barriers to flourishing. There are aspects of that problem for which the economic forces may play a role, but a subsidiary role. And in which capitalism may be fairly unimportant. You know, that is, the problem in question can be solved pretty well even in spite of capitalism. Capitalism doesn't throw up unsurmountable barriers for some problems, but not for others. So that's the general way I would approach it. I prefer to say that, as my general proposition is, that capitalism is a central part of most social problems, a central, and that the economic structure within capitalism is the central mechanism that renders capitalism capitalist. So the economic structure is the center, not a... The economic structure of capitalism isn't just an important feature of capitalism. That is the central feature that makes capitalism capitalism, is its economic structure. But that it's only a central, not the central, explanatory problem. Now, why are we focusing on it? Well, this is a lot of stuff to focus on in this class anyway. You know, I think, just like not every class in medical school will be on genetics, you'll have some on virology, some on cancer, some on genetics. I think this is a lot of material to absorb, and as long as it's, and because it has this importance, but not necessarily always being primary, I think that's the grounding for it. In terms of, just to foreshadow the point at the end of the semester, I think the reason why Marx made occasional efforts to explain the broad sweep of human history rather than just capitalism, why did he bother? Why bother talking about feudalism when what you really care is about the contradictions of capitalism and how to transform it? What's the point of going back 500 years, or even more, because Engels goes back to primitive communism and the origins of the family? Why bother? What's the point? Well, part of the point is just curiosity. You know, these are intellectuals, they're interested in things. But part of the point was a hope that by studying a broader array of societies and understanding the transformative logics between earlier human experiments in how to live, that might strengthen our understanding of how it works in capitalism. It was, I think, always subordinated to the purposes of understanding capitalism and its contradictions. And that led to a very, very ambitious attempt at theory construction, which ultimately I don't think is successful. It was an attempt at imagining that we could create an overarching grand theory of all of history within which capitalism could be located as one particular phase. And then if there were good arguments for this overall transcendent theory of history, that would provide greater foundations for the particular capitalist phase of that theory of history, even if all we really cared about was that. And I just don't think that's successful. I don't think the theory of history works. It has lots of insights. I'm not saying the opposite, that it's useless. It has lots of incredibly interesting insights. And as an intellectual foil to thinking about capitalism, it's helpful. You know, it's kind of, as a thought experiment, it's helpful. But I just don't think it holds up as an actual theory of history. I know we're over, just to leave you with one final thought. The most successful theory of history that we have is Darwinian biology, right? That is a successful theory. It's very robust. It's been modified and advanced over the last 150 years. But the structure is still intact at its core. And it explains you know, a billion years of the evolution of life. That's unbelievably successful as a theory of history. But note, it's entirely a retrospective theory of history. It helps us understand pretty adequately the development of species from single-celled organisms to complex animals today, over hundreds of millions of years. But it gives us no ability whatsoever to predict the next million years of evolution. You know, it's completely silent on the future. Has no way of predicting any evolutionary development. It's a theory of the history of the past, but it's not a history of the future. It tells us how we will explain after the fact what happens in the next 100 million years. You know, it does tell us how we will explain it, or whatever the we is that will be around, but it doesn't give us any prediction. And Marx's theory of history was an attempt at something more ambitious than evolutionary biology, because it wanted to be able to develop a history of the future, not just a history to the present. It's more like embryology, in a way. You know, that is, we know when you have a fertilized egg, we can predict the future, barring certain things that could happen to it. But we know that what the trajectory is. You know, there's only a certain limited number of trajectories from the point of a fertilized egg into the future. One trajectory is, becomes an embryo, becomes a fetus, it's born, becomes a toddler, becomes a teenager, etc. You know, we have a theory of the future of that zygote, right? We have a theory of the future because, and we understand the mechanisms with some gaps in our knowledge of cell differentiation and development. So we could say, from the start, we know the future, the destination, barring various contingent facts which might interrupt it. Right? So you can have a miscarriage. The baby could be stillborn. There's all the hazards that are contingencies. But we know that a fertilized human egg isn't going to result in a chicken. Right? We know that. We know a vast array of things that simply cannot happen. It's a very narrow band with unbelievably good predictive ability. The theory of the development of an organism is a powerful theory of the history of that particular entity from its conception until its death. Marx's theory of history was more like that, from primitive communism through slavery, feudalism, capitalism, to a destiny of communism. It was more like that than it is evolutionary biology. And I just think it's a fantastic intellectual construction, and it doesn't meet scientific criteria, I think. Well, we went over, sorry. Nobody should, you know, when it's 12, you should not feel awkward about saying you need to leave.